Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello again, and today we are once again talking about reframing risk. My name is Ashton Furie. Welcome to the Zawani Reframe Risk podcast series. I'm the founder of 5 to 50. We focus on businesses of at least five people that have been running for at least 5 years to grow them to 50 people as part of our initiative to help eradicate poverty by creating good jobs and moving forward God's kingdom on this earth. I'm also Group COO for KVR Equity. We are an investment company that invests in human capital solutions. And there we focus especially on training and human development. We do a lot of work in the learnership space where we help young people to become prepared for the workplace. So on the one hand, I try and help businesses grow so that they can create jobs. And on the other hand, I try and help young people be prepared so we can fill those jobs. Today, we are continuing our series about risk. We tackle the practical realities of taking bold steps in business. We reframe the conversations around taking gospel-inspired risks in Africa. But we also want to make sure that we give you the tools to ground yourself in professional responsibility. And today, our guest is one of my favorite people, Calista Grief. She's the founder at Zeal HR. We've known each other for a number of years. And Calista, I think you are a perfect guest for this podcast because I heard you say that you are always up for a bit of risk. Or as you said in Afrikaans, I think, and correct me if I'm quoting you wrong, altyd lus vir 'n bietjie risiko. So before we even get into your career journey, I want to know, why are you so keen on taking risks?
Hi, Ashton. Thank you so much. It's lovely and a privilege to be here. And yes, I remember that conversation very well where we were sitting and talking. And I remember also saying, it's altyd stout vir 'n bietjie risiko, which translates basically to always keen and up for a bit of a risk, because I think it makes life so much more interesting and spotting and considering opportunities. How boring would life be if we only all walk the same path and avoid all opportunities and other pathways? So I think that is something that I enjoy. But on a more serious note, I think it's important for us to be open-minded and look at what do we consider as risk. Because actually risk is the possibility of unpleasant or dangerous or undesirable outcomes. And that is literally with every decision that we make every day. So I think the framing of risk and what we perceive as risk makes a big difference as to how we can respond to that and recognizing that is into our smallest decisions, and that you're not guaranteed of not having an undesirable outcome when you take the path of least resistance or lowest risk. Of course, I have to say I'm not advocating for taking unwise risks. The reason I'm willing to take that risk is because of my security in Christ and walking in obedience to Him. And when we know that He is faithful and He is good, then we can walk with Him in unknown places and hold on to Him and trust Him in that.
I think when you say that God is faithful and God is good, it could be easy for listeners to maybe think that in your life, things have always just worked out well, which then makes it easy to look back and say, well, God is always faithful and God is good. But I don't think that this is the case if I think of the little bit I know about your story. So perhaps now is the time to ask you to tell us a little bit more about your career journey.
Thanks, Ashton. It's definitely not always been easy and worked out the way we planned. I think that's the beauty of life as well, to walk the journey out and see where God is leading you. So my journey in my career started by studying human resource management. I've always enjoyed people and business, and that was just a natural morph to work in that field. My first role was in labor relations, which I didn't enjoy as much as the other people interactions. And I moved to recruitment, which is much more positive and I think suits my upbeat and optimistic personality better. and then I progressed in my career in recruitment. And then in Pretoria, I was working at a national branch, a national business where I helped to open the Pretoria branch, and really loved the team and opportunity and what I was busy with. And in that season of my life, I got married to an engineer who is risk averse. Opposites attract, and obviously we balance each other out and sharpen each other's pencils. And I fell pregnant and really excited to, you know, take on that whole new journey. And I had fully paid maternity leave. I had good security in the role where I was. And I felt the stirring in my spirit that God is asking me to resign that role. And I remember having the discussion with my husband, because that is obviously a huge risk for us and doesn't make a lot of sense. There's no real reason for that. And it was in my third trimester of this pregnancy as well. So we were pretty deep into the journey, and we had saved some money, but just for the normal maternity leave period as well and unforeseen expenses. And at that stage, I was also the main breadwinner because I'd been working a bit longer than my husband. So that made it even more impractical. And I left it with my husband, and he prayed about it, and he came back to me and he said that he has peace about it. I knew that was a miracle, because out in the natural, that was just simply not possible. And that also put me back to the spotlight to, okay, will I be obedient to this now? Because I've already seen that miracle in that as well. And I went back to my employer and I had the uncomfortable conversation, and to say that there's nothing else other than I really feel that God is calling me to do this, and I'm not sure about the reasoning behind it. But little did I know that my son, that was about to be born, would be diagnosed with two rare conditions. So his diaphragm didn't develop fully. So all his organs shifted to his chest, his stomach and his intestines and his liver, and his lungs didn't develop. And the possibility of him not surviving birth was quite high. And then he would have to have a big operation and a long medical journey and high risk in all of that. So we literally had to then take that journey of all the unknowns, but really experiencing God's peace and presence. And he was diagnosed basically the last day that I had to hand in my laptop. So the timing was absolutely impeccable. He was then born 2 weeks earlier because they had to round up the specialists for the surgery. And I remember so clearly thinking that God being so faithful, because it was fully paid maternity leave, I would have had debt then. I would have had to pay back the money because he was in the hospital for 101 days. I was with him in the hospital every day from, you know, early morning until the latest hour at night, and just go home and sleep and go back. So there's no way that I would have been able to return to work, because after 101 days, he was sent home with life support. So there, it was really such a very big and strong conviction for me that God's call leads to his provision. So if I can walk in obedience to God, he provides in that, and he is outside of time, and his character is sure and certain. And that while we were navigating these storms, and praise God, he is turning 13 years old and he is an absolute miracle. So he is so, you know, faithful in the detail of that part. But what that meant for us from a career point of view is that I couldn't work then in an office, which at that stage, remote working was definitely frowned upon and definitely not serious or professional. So I started consulting a little bit in the hour, like after hours, and doing some interviews for highly specialized positions. And that just opened up my world a bit as well, because I was so literally focused in the room with my son, helping make sure that his oxygen stays in his nose so that he doesn't suffocate. And we don't have all the machines that the hospital has. So it was quite a stressful time. And for us to just go outside of, like, downstairs was like a bit of a holiday. So then interacting and helping people outside our house while we are really consumed in this journey of survival, really, was such an amazing gift to me as a person, being able to still serve and help other people while I'm really in need and in such a desperate place. So that was, I think, a really big learning curve and recognizing the value of that. So I'm so thankful that that has helped me a lot for other people and having that context to understand and know what that means. But that's how the consulting journey started. And when he was 3 years old, we moved to Cape Town because of oxygen. There's more oxygen in Cape Town than in Pretoria. And we moved to Cape Town in 2016 when I started the business called Zeal HR, which was at that stage a fully remote business because that was obviously my need. And I recognized there are many other mothers that have to kind of make the decision to be mutually exclusive, either full-time mom or full-time working, and that there's no space in the middle to really have a valuable career with the flexibility that you need. And that also can be kind of adjusted according to the season that you are in. And that is where we decided to build our business model in a way that we can give moms back to the household and now also dads. Now we are mostly moms and also two dads in the team, and also not fully remote anymore. So in a nutshell, that is a career journey that turned entrepreneurial starting the business. But that was also a response to obedience, where when we arrived in Cape Town, I didn't plan to start the business. And God said to me, okay, now would be a good time to start this business. And it was a conversation and figuring out what that looked like.
I think that is amazing. And just the confluence of risks that actually happened at that point in your life. And I have a little bit of experience of what it takes to start up a new business, to turn a business around, to those first years of having very little resource, and basically everything that you have to find within yourself. Well, that's what it often feels like. It can be really hard work. How did you cope with that kind of pressure in that time, and having the sense of I'm now dealing with this child that I am a mother of, that I'm keeping alive, but then at the same time almost giving birth to a second child in the form of a business, and saying, now I've got this business that I need to grow. How did you think about that? How did you work through that?
Initially, it was just a response to obedience and that, and then realizing, oh my goodness, all the responsibility and decisions that comes with that. And I suppose a bit of decision fatigue, but involving everyone. So I had a few people that were close to me that God had literally also positioned, that I thought, these are the people exactly that I'd like to solve the same problem for. And we made a lot of those decisions together. And it was almost as if my two risk baskets complemented each other, that sometimes my comfort would be in the other one while I'm busy with the one. And then also again, the inverse to be true. And I think that's the balance of life, that you can be in a really great place in your life, but also go through a very deep valley and still say that God is good and that it is well with my soul. And looking at the bigger picture and the context and the lens around that has made a very big difference. And I think that scripture in Proverbs 3, verse 5 to 6, to say to trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to him and he will make your path straight. And that speaks about surrender of control, but recognizing that faith replaces certainty with trust, and that we are not called to a life of certainty and to be certain of what will happen tomorrow or today or what the outcome of a decision will be or how that will work out. We are called to kind of walk faithfully and to kind of grow in our ability to surrender. And I think that is the biggest thing that has really been what I've learned, and also in just surrender in totality. None of us have certainty that we will wake up tomorrow, but in everyday decisions that I make, I also have to exert that kind of surrender of control and decisions. And that's much more difficult because it feels like I have a lot more control and influence, or some of it is like in a basket where I need God to sort this out. And it's obviously 100% great to part something's 100% God, and other things you're kind of wrestling through it. But to also have the same diligence to bring the things that you think are minuscule or not as big or important or something that you should be able to solve, but you are struggling to do so. Those are the things we should also be walking in a life of surrender. So I think that's been one of the biggest tools that I've received from that journey, and that is some gems you can only find in the desert. And I think that's the one thing to kind of learn to yield to God and walk in surrender. And yeah, that ties in with the risk component of it as well.
Sure. That is really a lot of deep ideas and experiences that you have now distilled into a few really important concepts, I think. So I want to just take a moment to capture a few of those. And one of the things you mentioned is the difference between certainty and trust. And that as Christians, we may not have certainty in what is physically going to happen, but we can trust in a God. And we can have certainty in that there is a God who loves us, there is a God who has a plan, and that we are walking in that plan. The other word you used was control. And I think very often we think that risk is diminished when we have more control. And I think that is really, we have this illusion of control, but in reality, we are actually constantly at risk of things going wrong. Yeah, that we have no control over. So if we delve a bit deeper into the concept of risk itself, we talk about risk, we assume that others have the same understanding, but I've realized that people often have very different views and associations with risk. So maybe take a moment to just say, or just tell us, how would you define risk?
So when I looked at the definition around it, it says the possibility of unpleasant or dangerous or undesirable outcomes. And I think how I perceive risk to be is to look at what is the odds of something actually working out in the way that you think it would, which you actually never really know. So it kind of helps you make a bit of calculations around what you can possibly expect in risk. So it's not reckless going into it blind and saying that it doesn't matter what, we will go and tackle this scenario. You can maybe be a bit more prepared in what the different variables could be in risk. And how do you define what success looks like in what you're trying to achieve? So that also, I think, puts the weight of risk on different elements. So if you look at a business, to say traditionally, the risk would be perhaps not growing at the rate that you have, or losing some market share, or having different undesirable outcomes. I think that would classify as undesirable. But for you to look at saying, well, if that means that there is stability in the team, you might not have reached the profit targets, but you have grown significantly in your team. There has been a lot of employment growth and good stability and morale, and being able to service, let's say, your clients or your customers in a way that enables trust and growth and retention. I think the risk is not necessarily that much. So kind of distributing what do you classify the different elements to say, how do you determine if success was achieved, and what were the risks really? Because you can have a highly successful business on paper, but you have very high staff turnover, and the risk of your reputation internally with families, with, you know, the clients or customers that you are working with. So I think the definition of how you perceive it and how you respond to that risk as well, because a lot of people then just go to control, and you control as much as you can. And that is something kind of that will never be satisfied. The moment you start feeding into that, you will need a bit more control. You would need to have more information. There will need to be more kind of channels into how you manage situations, versus trying to move to an ownership and saying, well, that there is trust and there is margin for variables. But kind of the growth that happens with that, and actively fighting the control, because I believe that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And to try and to build freedom versus control into the different ways that we approach scenarios that you would typically look at when you are considering risk.
I really like the way that you broke those up into sort of different areas of risk: financial risk, reputational risk, staff turnover risk. I think that really helps to understand in each one of those, what's the variable, what's the certainty and the uncertainty, what are the things that could go wrong. But then also what I really liked is how you defined risk in terms also of the goals or the outcomes that you want to achieve. So that really helps, I think, the listeners to think through it in a kind of a framework where you go define the four or five or six key areas in your business that are really important for you. And not necessarily, those are not necessarily the same for everybody in terms of sequence of priority. And then asking yourself, what are the variables in those? What can I predict with reasonable certainty and with reasonable uncertainty? And then what are the actions that I can take? But then on top of that, you put the whole thing of control and saying, so there's so much action that I can take, but I also have to make peace with the fact that I'm trying to create an environment where people can live in freedom and live out their own purpose and what they are accomplishing in their own growth. So creating an environment of freedom, which actually in a certain way raises your risk. But as you were saying that, I also realized that I've seen it over and over again. When a leader or a founder tries too hard to control every variable, they become so busy. And as you said, now you need more and more inputs, more and more information. So effectively, they become the growth constraint on the business because you only have so many hours in a day in which to actually try and manage and control all these variables. And if you are allowing those variables to become the overarching thing that you're managing by, then you lose focus of the end goal and you create an environment where people can't really flourish and thrive. So I think to tap onto that in terms of the way that you approach it could look very different. I mean, you were in a situation where you said, I need a mechanism of earning an income while I am working from home, while I have flexibility to look after my child. And you ended up building a business that I think is a very counterintuitive business model. Maybe today for people, it'll be a little bit more normal because of what's happened through COVID. But at the time when you built a business where you kind of made remote working the default method of operation, that was not normal at all. Tell us a bit more about that journey. How did you think about that, and how did you just manage the all the uncertainty and the risk that comes with building a business model that most people at that point in time would have told you, like, this can't work?
Yes, it was absolutely unconventional at that stage, and I have been so thankful that I've never had to pitch our business model for funding, because I recognize that would have been a very awkward conversation. Because initially when I sat with the business and recognizing that I want to have the freedom to be able to work and to do what I do well, but also create that space for other people. But the reality is my capacity is limited. I don't have the time or ambition to kind of grow a team and build all kinds of structures now. I want to have a very flexible but solid structure to create opportunity for others to do the same as what I am doing. And there is a lot of risk in that. So the way that I spoke to God and said, okay, well, for us, that means to say, we're bringing in people as consultants, as business partners, where there's a shared income. And for us, in terms of the industry that we're in, a lot of times there's a commission-based focus, and the minority of the commission would go to the consultant, the majority would go to the company. We flipped it around where the majority of the commission goes to the consultant and the minority goes to Zeal. All of us had vested interest in the success of each other. And I think that is the basis of our business and the way that we've built it out now, 10 years later still. The baseline of our business, and I think success in that, is that our success lies in the success of each other and that we can't achieve it alone. And typically in these industries, it's very competitive and people kind of trample on each other to achieve success. But it's because the business model allows or kind of encourages it in that way. So maybe there might be some listeners that are thinking there are some structural changes that you can look at and consider in your business to promote there's actually better opportunity for people to win if they win together versus saying we are collaborative, we are a team together. But actually, if you look at your incentives or kind of performance rewards or, you know, however you structure it in your business, if that is only on individual success, that you are cultivating a culture where you are enjoying the people next to you probably, but if you had to choose between them or you, you choose you. Where you can have a sacrificial type of business where we are better and stronger together. Like I sacrifice, we win. And it's always so interesting for me to see in the team how people stand back and say, no, this is actually great. You can perhaps run with this part or I can run with that part, with very high trust with people that have not necessarily worked together that long. But that is the way that it also kind of spreads risk among each other. You already have extra capacity and shared responsibility in that. So technically, you can take on a lot more work. We need to be able to set each other up for success. And what does that look like in to some of the structures and policies and expectations and how we do and provide that? And I think that's a constant journey, and also the tension that businesses need to ask around, you know, remote working or home working or policies or expectations and levels and teams and all those complexities.
So Calista, one of the things you mentioned earlier, and we sort of touched on that, but I want to double click and go a little bit deeper into that because I know it's one of the areas where you are quite unique in your approach. And that is that most businesses, as they grow, they try and get bigger and bigger clients. I mean, it's just easier to make more money with bigger clients. And I think most recruitment consultants also prefer working with a large company that is continuously posting new roles, and they've got a database of CVs. They mine the CVs, they fill those roles. But you specifically try to focus also on small businesses, which I think makes your business quite a bit harder than maybe what some of your competitors are facing. Tell me a little bit about that, what you find, how you manage that, what are the risks you see there and how you manage those.
Yes, thanks, Ashton. I think traditionally, earlier in my career at the places where I've worked, most of the clients were bigger corporate clients, like you said, and then there would be a few key businesses where there is quite a lot of work. So risk is kind of still spread, but kind of between a few big clients. And typically, relationships are key to those specific businesses, like entry doors. And if someone, like let's say the talent manager, whatever, leaves and someone new takes over, a lot of times that they come with their own relationships and suppliers that they bring in. So it's not to say that although you've got a service level agreement that you can continue there. And I remember also in 2009 when the recession kind of swooped in, it was quite unexpected. And one day we got a call to just have all our big clients phone and say, we're canceling interviews, we're canceling interviews, we're canceling interviews with people that they invited for interviews. And interestingly, our smaller businesses didn't phone. They had the interviews and they even made appointments, whereas zero of the corporate businesses continued because they just had a lock on all new appointments. So as we were building our business, we said from the onset that we would like to partner with businesses that we have shared values and that we have a really good kind of vetting process in terms of what do we know about the business, what do their employees say about working there, what can we see and find out around how they feel and do about things. A lot of times when they give you the brief around what they want in a person and what it is like there and how strict they are on certain things, you can already make a few deductions around those things. But what we want to achieve is to have really great placements in the sense that people find their best jobs, hopefully, you know, when they have applied and been placed through us. And the flip side is that we never ever want to have a person saying they got their worst job of their life with where we had placed them. So obviously we work with what we've known. We try to be diligent in finding out that information. But from a smaller business's point of view, we also recognize that smaller businesses don't necessarily have the access to people spending as much time and effort and really care around what they need, because their needs are much different from what a corporate, you know, business would be. They need a different type of person that would be able to flourish and thrive and not be paralyzed by the diversity of the needs that lies before them in a smaller business. And that is really crucial. If you appoint someone wrong in a smaller team, the knock-on effect of that is huge. The entire team feels it, and it can have vast risks for the business as well. So we kind of feel and carry the responsibility of that part, and being able to join a business and help solve that problem and play someone good is really something that makes us our hearts beat faster and really gives great purpose to us. And we decided that we would rather build a lot of relationship in a lot of these businesses. So most of our businesses are actually small to medium enterprises. We've got a few select like corporate or bigger businesses that we work with and partner. But our focus would be rather to help one business with one or two people that they're appointing, and they have really been able to grow. You're helping the local economy to also kind of really create good traction in the business, what they're doing, what type of person they would need to have that. And the flip side of that, which we didn't anticipate, is they'd be so happy they would tell their friends and other businesses. So what has happened is that we don't really do business development, actually. We kind of building capacity the whole time to catch the business that's being referred to us. And it's also difficult to say, no, you don't have capacity, because you sincerely really want to help each of these businesses, because there are personal ties with someone's friend. And so we've been growing and trying to build capacity around that. And it's been so interesting to see the positive effects for us. For instance, there's no negotiation around how can we extend the payment period. With corporates, even early in my career, that would be extended from 30 days to possibly 60 days. And I remember then the trend kind of going up to the bigger clients to then say, well, even 90 days. Now, to render a service and be paid, you know, 3 months later is for cash flow. And again, we are also a small business. So with smaller businesses, most of our clients pay within 14 days, but we're also flexible and depending on what their cash flow is to kind of make arrangements if you can pay it over 2 months or whatever. But most of them pay within the first, some even the same day or the next day. We've got zero, you know, need to have a team to focus on collecting the money that needs to be paid to us for services rendered, because it's highly relational. So the benefits of that has been really great. And I've spent quite a bit of time with other businesses and encouraging the wonderful value that lies within small to medium enterprises in South Africa, and building that not just from a relational point of view or like this is great for our country point of view, but really in terms of lowering your risk, and it's spread wide and far. So certainly we would be more profitable if we had a super niche that we're only servicing a specific market, and if it was maybe big companies and also companies with high turnover. In other words, not necessarily great cultures, because they would have to fill that position every year or every 6 months or 8 months. You're beyond your probationary period or kind of guarantee period. So there's no financial risk kind of beyond that for us. But that for some companies is a great company to have, because you can bill in a year or 2 years much more than you would from a smaller company. But is that the right thing? I don't think that is the right thing.
I think one of the things that I've experienced in working with small business founders is often the question of, well, who to employ next? And I've seen so often that decision made wrong, especially when founders try and find another me. And they go, oh, so for me to not be so busy anymore, I need another me. And I think it was Daniel Strauss. I hope I'm quoting the right person. I think it was him that said you should employ somebody that's 20% like you and 80% different. And then by the time you've employed your first sort of five people, you've actually got like 400% of the capacity that you used to have when it was just you. And I think it's Derek Sivers, he wrote the book Anything You Want, and he says you should employ people that do the things you hate doing. So just ask yourself, what do I enjoy the least? The next person I employ is the person who enjoys doing that the most. And you surround yourself with people who love doing the things you don't like doing until everybody's just doing what they love doing. And then obviously the other thing that most people look at is just skill set, like what am I good at versus what other people are good at. I think those are different great views of looking at it. But I really like the way that you approach it by saying, let me understand your culture, let me understand who you are as a company, do we have a values match? And that you literally, if I understand you correctly, you'll walk away from a client if you don't feel the match is there. You're not prepared to help. Yeah, you're not prepared to help build a bad culture, which I think is so important in where we are today. I've had the unfortunate experience of working once or twice in my life in environments with very, very unpleasant working environments. And the impact that that has on one personally is really significant. I want to take a left turn and ask you about South Africa specifically. So talking to founders in South Africa, small businesses in South Africa, maybe even bigger businesses, but also to maybe investors, people that are listening from the US and from Europe and abroad that are looking at investing in South Africa. What are some of the important things to think about that are maybe unique in terms of South Africa's HR environment as opposed to what they might be used to in other environments?
Yes, I think South Africa is starting to get a lot of international attention. A strong trend that we are seeing, as well as other companies or other countries starting to employ local talent on employer of record models. So to work remotely for companies, because it's kind of outsourcing sections of business to South Africa, because the workforce is, I think the innovation that we have in our country is unparalleled in most other cultures. Obviously, there's a lot of background and history to it, but because there has been a lot of challenges and a lot of changing environments, you have to be adaptable and innovative and to spot the gap that you can see and then move swiftly to grab the opportunity, which is not as structured as many other countries that are kind of waiting, kind of give me an instruction, I'll wait, I'll do it well. I might not do it as fast or as kind of, you know, thinking, but what if? And I think what other countries are finding refreshing in terms of our market is the diligence and the skills that we have here. And we can be proud of this in South Africa. In terms of South Africans in character, I think for the global audience, there is a big appeal around the quality of the work that we have. And we see that in sports and many other places where we shine in that, where it's kind of character and also kind of pushing through with the resilience that we need. But what does that mean for business owners in South Africa? You have a lot of innovative people in your team. And sometimes for some roles, you don't need the innovation. You need the execution. So again, understanding what do you need in each role, because that will lead to higher turnover, correct? So knowing what you need in the position and also playing to people's strengths. So I think the superpower that small to medium enterprises have that they don't often recognize and utilize is you can be adaptable enough to build functions around really great people. And you can have a really great person not flourishing in this exact expectation and role. And as you said, Ashton, that we need to surround ourselves with people that are not the same as us, because otherwise we'd be competing for tasks, because technically you love doing what you're doing and you don't want to give that away because you love doing what you're doing. But if you have a person that's compatible, so the compatibility component that you also mentioned, like 20% compatible, and not complete opposite, that you don't understand each other, because you need to be able to understand each other. So I think that's such an important thing to pause and reflect on what you've shared there, because we see this every day. Is there needs to be enough synergy that we can work together well, but that you do things that I don't enjoy doing. And I can just say, thank you that you are doing this thing that I don't really want to do and that this makes you tick. And I will catch you in other parts that makes me tick. And then you feel the value and the relief of a team. Whereas if you are having a lot of people that are the same, you're feeling kind of the competition and friction in a team. Recognizing the different dynamic that it takes, because to your point earlier, Ashton, as well, a wrong person joining the team, it's like when you're baking a cake and you put in the wrong ingredient in the cake, the entire cake will taste bad. It's not just the wrong ingredient. As a business owner, you'll see that. As investors, you'll see that when people are really doing and working in the places where they're doing well. And I think that's one of the things JobJack, which is a platform for entry-level recruitment, does well, where they help and have different skills things for the retail market where that is vetted well beforehand. And I said to them, I'm so encouraged by the wonderful redemptive gift you're giving people for them being placed in the right environment, because it's difficult to test and see that. So it's kind of trial and error being mostly up to now. And they're changing that landscape because that gives that person stability on his CV in his employment record. It gives him good references because he's performed well, because he's in the right environment. So that's more of what we need in our country. And the bigger purpose and dignity and stability that gives that person and families and communities, the ripple effect is huge. So I think in the South African landscape, and just lastly on your question, is that we've got one of the strictest labor laws in the world. So it's very different from, let's say, America or Australia, where you can easily hire and also fire people, you know, without a lot of, and that's very normal. You'd easily find another role or kind of be onboarded and offboarded quite quickly. Whereas in South Africa, that is not the case. And I think understanding that in South Africa and how you work and do that is also how you view the risk in that and what, how you see the people in the team. So if you are building out a function to see, does it work to maybe have customer service in South Africa from an Australian company? You can't say, well, this guy had a bad call today, we're just letting him go. That does not work like that in South Africa. There's an entire process to follow. And even for small to medium enterprises, like businesses in South Africa, which has recently changed, they've kind of lightened the load a bit because saying, according to what you know, so how they will 100% determine what the people knows would be interesting to see in kind of, you know, case law going forward, but also trying to make it less strict so that people are not scared to employ people because they're scared they can't face the CCMA repercussions. So I would rather burn out or kind of have independent contractors, which are actually employees, but scared to enter into employment agreements. So the government is looking at how to kind of, you know, counter that part and encourage economic growth, which we are seeing now with a lot of good reports in the last while around good economic growth and making changes that have been not made in a long time. But then now all of the businesses needs to navigate all these changes as well. And what does this mean for employment contracts? What does this mean for relationships like the parental leave, which was previously maternity leave and paternity leave, that is now parental leave. And so I think in South Africa, you need to be able to really pay attention to these things because it does affect you.
So one of the things I really enjoyed, Calista, as you were talking about small businesses a little bit earlier, I just want to connect to that quickly. Because when I first came back from China in 2017 and felt God saying it's time to come back to South Africa, I had this question of like, so where do we focus if we want to eradicate poverty and create good jobs? And I came to that same conclusion that big businesses grow when the economy grows, and then they go through rounds of retrenchment when the economy goes down. Startups have an extremely high failure rate. So that's not really a good place to try and create a lot of jobs consistently. But small businesses that have been running for a few years, that are already employing a few people, those are the ones that tend to need growth, employ more people. And that's also where people can grow. I definitely found like one of my first positions in my early career was I came in as an engineer in an IT business. And I left that business as national operations manager 5 years later, because as the business grew, my position just grew. You know, there was no national operations manager when we were 10 people in Durban. But by the time I left the company, we had offices all over the country. So that kind of growth forces personal growth. And that's also one of the things that really excites me about what we do at KVR in terms of learnerships, because what we try and do is give young people that more practical sort of footing. And if you're part of a learnership, you also get practical experience. So you get placed at an employer, you have to get work experience. And that I think is really a way that we can help young people. And I think something else, maybe for international people especially, you do not know, South Africa has a very young population. And so does the rest of Africa. But that means that while the rest of the world are looking at like, how do we deal with this like massive retirement problem, in South Africa, we're going like, we've got a bunch of young people coming into the workforce. And as my friend Matthew Blewett always says, some of us are pro-human. So while AI and all of that is busy happening, we in Africa, we go AI, African intelligence. We know that we can do things in a way that no machine ever can. And so we are pro-human. We believe that there is a future for young people in the market. And that's one of the things I really like about what you do. If I just think back of the two youngsters that you placed with us a few years ago, when I the first two people that we ever got from you, like just the quality of people that you placed. And exactly at the time, I wasn't aware of everything you've just told me in terms of matching culture and trying to make sure that they're a right fit. Now that I know that, I understand why it worked so well. But I think sort of as a word to all entrepreneurs, you know, whether you use recruitment agencies or not, thinking about it from this perspective of how can I create an opportunity for people to grow? Is there significant enough diversity that I'm not just creating internal friction and competition? I really liked what you said about task competition, of saying if I employ too many people that are the same, then we're all competing for the same tasks. And if we can just figure those things out. At one stage, I remember we used to run this exercise where we used to barter tasks. And we would once a week, we would sit around a table and we'd go like, in the next week, I have to do this, this, and this thing that I really don't feel like doing. And then somebody else in the table can go, I'll do that, but then I need you to do this. And we would begin to barter our tasks until we each just had a plate full of tasks that we go like, I really want to do this work. But there was always a few things that we go like, nobody wants to do this. And then we just go, okay, well, somebody's got to take one for the teams. So Calista, I think the other thing you are doing is giving people an opportunity to thrive by being placed in a place where they can actually work in their strengths. And that is redemptive in itself. So just such a pleasure talking to you and hearing the amazing work that you do. Anything else that you want to add? Some last comments?
I think the last comment that while you were talking now, I recognize that I think it's a valuable tip for an employer or entrepreneur in South Africa is that when you have people in your team that provide a lot of pushback or friction or feedback in that is to see perhaps how you frame it, because that helps you to kind of build excellence. So to not just see it as, well, this person doesn't fit into the team. Everyone else accepts it. This person doesn't accept it. There's also purpose in that where you can have that kind of conflict part that really actually enables excellence and that you need people to question and think differently. So to not, I know in HR we speak about groupthink, right? So you don't want everyone to kind of think the same way, but also to be open and to welcome feedback and things that you don't agree with necessarily, and to push through the discomfort, because that would take you to excellent places, because you don't have that perspective and don't feel that friction or pain in a way that that person sees or has access or perceives it, whatever. So that is something else that we've also seen many times. If it's that, they say, well, this person doesn't fit into the culture, or it doesn't necessarily live our values. And obviously there's ways and means about it, but to not build similar opinions beyond skills, but people that do provide that pushback and to give you the feedback, to take it in a way to say, well, this is building our excellence and what can we fix to do it? Because obviously you want that to stop. So you have to fix these things for that to be then solved. But essentially that is taking you to higher excellence levels.
I really like that. That takes us full circle back to risk, because I think very often we have blind spots, especially in small businesses as entrepreneurs. And if we can learn to be comfortable with those uncomfortable conversations and say, give me your diverse viewpoint, tell me the thing that I didn't think about, the thing I didn't see, the risk that you see that I don't see, then we can mitigate risk in that way as well. Calista, thank you very much. It has been great. Thank you, listeners, and we will see each other again on the next round.
Thank you, Ashton.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.